In a global pandemic, music can provide a lot of solace. So today, during our global pandemic, we're going to take a look back at some rock and roll and pop classics that in some ways may speak to our current pandemic predicament. You're hearing one of those right now from Todd Rundgren. And we couldn't ask for a better tour guide this morning. Mark Myers is back with us. He writes the Anatomy of a Song column for the Wall Street Journal, and he's the author of the books Anatomy of a Song, The Oral History of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop, and Why Jazz Happened. He posts daily at jazzwax.com, and that's a website that I look at every single day, and you might want to consider it too. Mark, what a pleasure to have you back again. Welcome.
Oh, Steve, thanks for having me. Good to hear you.
We're going to listen to some of the songs you've written about in just a moment and some others. But man, has music ever been more important than it is right now?
Yeah, it's true. It's transportive, isn't it? People are going back to a time before the pandemic and the political insanity. It's sort of a time machine. And I think it's nostalgic, too, don't you? I mean,
absolutely.
The vinyl production and sales are up, and people like holding albums and turntables. It takes them back to, again, an earlier time. And I guess even though concerts are on hold, many artists are performing online. So it's interesting how the sound of music takes you out of the current situation and puts you back in a period that feels today, I guess, a little calmer.
You know, it's so interesting to me. You write about so many artists that are in danger of being lost to time. How do you figure out what to listen to on any given day, what to write about on any given day?
Well, I mean, when it comes to, for instance, Jazz Wax, which I, you know, devote to jazz mostly, but even the songs chosen for my Wall Street Journal column on Anatomy of a Song, I'm always looking for something that's great, but that has fallen through the cracks. That's not as popular as people think, but they'll know it once they hear it. And the reaction I'm always shooting for is either, oh my God, I didn't even know that song, or, oh, I remember that. Oh my God, I haven't heard that in so long.
I've been meaning to ask you this for years. You've talked to so many great artists over the years, Smokey Robinson, Grace Slick, Sheryl Crow, Roberta Flack, Joni Mitchell, Mick Jagger. How do you even know how to get in touch with them?
Well, I mean, it's timing. You really do have to time it when they have something coming out so that they're more amenable to talking to the media. And then it's reputation. You know, it's just building your reputation as someone who's a straight shooter that, you know, doesn't sabotage these artists. And then really what I focus on when I speak with them, which is what wins them over, is the art of what they do. I'm not interested in the dish. I'm really interested in the creative process.
Well, let's turn to Rundgren's Hello, It's Me that we heard opening this segment. I mean, this wasn't the original version of the song, right?
It came a little earlier. Todd wrote it for the original group before it became Todd Rundgren and Utopia. It was Naz. Mm-hmm. But Naz, of course, you know, there was a name of a band that existed, so they changed the name. But the song itself almost sounds like a demo if you go onto YouTube and type in Naz plus Hello, It's Me. But the thing about the song that's so interesting is that he wrote it. It was written when he was putting together an album in 72, he thought back to sort of what could I write about? And it reflected on an emotionally painful high school breakup, which I guess is probably the motivator for 90% of songs out there. But
no kidding.
In the 60s, he was the only one in school in Philadelphia with long hair. Now, for those who are sort of scratching their heads out there and saying, yeah, so what? You have to understand that back then in the late 60s and early 70s, even long hair was it was a political statement. And you've instantly declared who you were, that you sided with the hippie culture and the peace and love movement. And the crew cut crowd would, you know, come after you. So that was a big thing. And one day, I guess, you know, when Todd told me when he was walking his girlfriend home, this is how hot a topic long hair was. Her father turned the garden hose on him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. That hurts. Yeah.
This song, you know, she broke up with him.
This song came to him, you wrote, when he was sitting in a wheelchair.
Yeah, he was writing this in a house where the wheelchair just existed, and he just liked sort of being on that thing. But you know, the thing about this song, by the way, it's released in 1973, mm-hmm. and the song went to number 5 on the Billboard pop chart. It's the interesting thing about Todd Rundgren is that he was a tech nerd before there was tech. Huh. In other words, he was overlaying, he was layering, he was overdubbing, he was putting together multiple instruments, synthesizers, just building this complex song. But this is one of the most pop of Todd's songs.
Yes,
if you listen
yes.
to his out, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And but it's a great tune.
Oh, you never get tired of hearing it.
I'll be back with Mark Myers in just a few minutes, but right now we want to let you know how you can continue to hear great conversations like this one. That's Carly Simon, the track Nobody Does It Better, and we're doing this conversation as a new James Bond film, No Time to Die, comes out in April. Mark, you write that this song was something of a first because it was the first Bond theme written from a woman's perspective. Tell us about that.
Yeah, when I interviewed Carol Bayer-Sager, who co-wrote this mm-hmm. song, she wrote the lyrics. I asked her, you know, it has such a female feel. I mean, it's the woman speaking. It's the woman singing about Bond, sort of sizing him up and rating him sexually, right? Mm-hmm. And that had never been done before. All of the Bond themes were sort of glorifying Bond's prowess. And here you had this song, from a woman's angle. And she said, you know, I didn't set out to do it that way, but that instead of singing passively about being loved by Bond, she wanted the Bond gal to sort of rate him. And you have to understand, the overlay you have to drop on top of this is that the women's liberation movement is in full swing mm-hmm. at this point, and that Nobody Does It Better is sort of this euphemism back then that guys are sort of using. And it was, she said, it was fascinating to sort of put that euphemism in the woman's voice. Huh. About him.
You say this song was fun for you because it provided a couple of mysteries that you wanted to run down. What were those mysteries?
Well, before I even talk about that, one of the great things here, when I was interviewing Carly Simon, mm-hmm. she actually sang this for me over the phone.
Oh, is that
right? She sang the chorus. And let me tell you, the hairs on my neck went up because Carly's voice sounds exactly the way it did.
Wow.
It has that urgency and that maternal sound, you know, mm-hmm. it still has that feel. But I was
You described her yeah. once as a bookend to Mick Jagger, which I thought was a great analogy. I'd never thought about it that way before.
Yeah, I mean, they both have that look and
yes,
that feel
absolutely.
And that freewheeling, you know, peacocky kind of performing sensibility. But I was always curious about this song because it seemed like it naturally or logically would be Marvin Hamlisch playing because he's the one who wrote the music
yes.
With Carol Bayer-Sager.
But it wasn't.
But I wasn't sure. And I wanted to really, you know, and I had to drill down through like 4 different people to nobody could remember. And they thought it was this person. They thought it was that person. And someone was sure it wasn't Marvin. And I finally tracked down the person who played piano. It was a fellow by the name of Michael Omardian.
Right.
And Michael is a studio pianist who's on hundreds of albums. But he was called in to do it because, you know, Marvin played it the first time through, and the producer felt that Marvin wasn't being for lack of a better word, robotically in time. You know, when you're recording, the musicians have to be robotically in time. You can't have any loose ends there. And Marvin wasn't quite as on time as he should have been. And the producer, Richard Perry, you know, said, Marvin, why don't you sit out? Let Michael take a shot at it. Because they tried with him about six times. And finally, Michael sat down and aced it right away, because that's what those guys do.
Why was Carly Simon picked for this song?
Carol Bayer-Sager really wanted her, because at this point in time, Carly is... There's a freeness about her. There's a sensuality about Carly. If you recall, there's this.
I do recall.
She's
Mark.
Different. Yeah, she's different than all of the other female singer songwriters at this point in time. She's not Joni. She's not Judy Collins. There's a hippie quality to her that doesn't exist with the others quite, but also a sensuality, a real sensuality. And she just felt that the sound of her voice was a Bond, you know, Bond gal waking up next to James Bond, it would have that feel and it would be convincing.
And it probably didn't hurt that Carly Simon was a big James Bond fan.
You know, I don't, it's funny, because everybody I spoke to, everybody who's recorded a James Bond theme, it was a James Bond fan. I mean, who isn't, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're a singer and you're a singer-songwriter, my goodness, even Carol Bayer-Sager was just gushing about, you know, wow, she was going to get to write a James Bond theme. So everyone was sort of very passionate about it. And Carly, you know, you wouldn't expect Carly to be a James Bond fan, right? Mm-hmm. You sort of expect her to be more Laurel Canyon than London, you know? And, you know, Carly was like, no, I was so freaked. I mean, I just couldn't believe that I was going to write that I was going to sing a James Bond theme. And she's all the way in. You can really hear it. You can really hear it in her voice.
This was interesting to me, too, because you wrote that the strings and the orchestration were added after she cut her part.
Isn't that fascinating?
It is,
And the disagreement between Marvin wanted to end this song, the long version of this song, with sort of a frozen fade out, you know, like would land on a note and then sort of leave it at that. And he was thinking cinematically with that. But the arranger, Richard Hewson, who's British, he wanted this British all you need is love kind of horn thing going on, where it felt like the changing of the guard. I mean, if you listen to those horns at the back end of this song, there's a all you need is love feel. And Richard Perry came down on Richard Hewson's side. He said that, you know, as a British agent, secret agent 007, that you really needed that British flavor, that scent of Britishness in there.
You're listening to Up to Date. It takes the support of listeners like you to make conversations like the one I'm having right now with Mark Myers. You can make sure they continue by making a pledge to the station that bring those to you. That's KCUR. Nobody. That's Huey Lewis, of course, and The Power of Love. Mark, you described Huey as going against the grain back in the mid-80s when he hit it big with this song and so many others. He was the guy down the street, you say, at a time when everybody else was dressing outlandishly and sort of coming off in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, Huey doesn't get enough credit, really. I mean, he is the voice of the 80s. I mean, that voice, if you listen to that, forget about, you know, whether you like this song or not, or whatever, however you feel about the song. If you just listen to a couple of his songs and just listen to his voice and what he's doing with that voice, it's really a remarkable voice. And I think he doesn't get enough credit because he's so casual and he's so easygoing. And, you know, he's sort of like the best, either the best friend you had or the best friend you wish you had in high school or college, right? He's just, and he's also a great guy. I mean, as an interview, he's just a wonderful, warm person. That song went to number one in 85.
Wow.
Obviously, piggybacking on Back to the Future's popularity when that movie came out, I mean, everybody went to see that once or twice, right?
You say he almost passed on writing this song. Why?
They called him in before the movie was out. They called him in and they said, you know, we love you. We love all these hits, man. You gotta write a movie. You gotta write a song for our movie coming out. And Huey says, okay, you know, what's the title? And they said, oh, it's Back to the Future. And that was just, you know, all Huey could hear was like, sha-na-na. You know, it's like, I don't want to go back. You know, I don't want to go back in time. We're a future band. Mm-hmm. We're heading forward. Going back? I don't think so. I don't, you know. And they said, look, well, what's the problem? And Huey said, look, we don't go backward. We're going forward. And the producer said, look, give me your next song. Whatever the next song is, we'll take it. You know, it doesn't have to be tied into the, you know, you don't have to use those words, Back to the Future, anything you got. So Huey says, all right, you know, give that a shot. And he remembered driving home to up into Northern California, to Marin County. On the drive home, he remembered that Chris Hayes, the guitarist for the News, dropped off a demo. And he said, let me see what I can do with that. And when Chris Hayes dropped off the demo, of course, for those who know what a demo is, it's just really the music and it's rough. It's just, hey, I got these ideas, Huey, listen to these. I'm leaving a cassette at your house. So Huey pops it into his Walkman, puts on his sneakers, and he goes for a run.
Right, right.
And during this run, he's thinking about his new wife and his newly arrived daughter with his son on the way. And all he can think of is the phrase power of love. And he writes the lyrics on the run and writes them down when he gets home. And, you know, it's crazy, Steve. Don't you think how songs are born? Like, this song was just, it was a confluence of almost accidents. Like, hey, I got a demo for you.
Right.
Hey, there's a meeting about the movie. Puts the two together, starts to write. And, you know, that's how it comes together.
You know, didn't you ask him about this idea that he composed the song while he was writing? How did he remember the words he had come up with while he was out for a jog?
Yeah, my favorite thing to do. I mean, this is going to sound counterintuitive because those who don't do what I do for a living would think it goes the other way. But I really do work hard to come up with dumb questions. And when I say dumb questions,
welcome to my
world.
Questions.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's questions that like everybody else would have, no matter how stupid the question sounds. Right. So I kind of know what the answer is going to be, but you know, the answer always comes out weird. So I said to Huey, look, I said, that sounds great. It sounds perfectly plausible, but to the average person who goes for a run, I don't know, you know, I can barely remember a phone number, or I can barely remember something that I came up with in the shower or something, an idea, and I forgot to write it down. How are you remembering lyrics to a song? And he goes, you have to understand. He said, I'm a performer. And like any actor, you know, I live on stage, and like any actor, I have to remember a script. I'm trained to remember words. I'm not out there with a sheet of paper singing when I'm performing. I'm remembering the lyrics. And that's the same thing here, which was sort of like a dumb moment. But at the same time, it was, wow, that is fascinating. I never thought of it that way.
You had one other nugget about this song that just is worth, I think, talking about just briefly here. Because Huey shared the royalties with his former bandmate, who had given him the name, the idea of the power of love or whatever. He didn't have to share the royalties, but he did so anyway.
Says a lot about him,
it
really.
It does, absolutely.
You know, when he could have taken the credit, he didn't. He had been in a band earlier, a studio band that recorded quite a bit in England, sort of backing Elvis Costello as well, eventually. But it was a band called Clover. And these guys were just like, they were like the Funk Brothers in Motown. These guys recorded on a lot of albums. And one of the guys in the band, he remembered that when Huey came up with the power of love idea on the run, he remembered that his friend had, that it probably popped into his head because his friend had it. And he didn't want to step on his friend's toes. And he didn't want to take something that his friend had come up with. So he called him up and he said, hey, did you ever title a song called Power? Did you ever record something called Power of Love? And the friend said, no, I had it in a song. We never really recorded it, but you know, we were working that out, but it was in a song that I had, but we never did much with it. And Huey said, well, you're in luck. He goes, I want to use it, and I'm giving you a piece of the action.
Well, more music's coming. You're listening to Up to Date. My guest this hour, Mark Byers. This program brings you in-depth conversations. Please show your appreciation with a pledge of support. We'll be back for more with Mark in just a few minutes. I'm Steve Kraske. That's the power of love. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. I'm talking today with Mark Byers of the Wall Street Journal. Now, I hold in my hands, Mark, the envelope with the final song of our time today. It, too, needs no introduction. Here we go. That's Earth, Wind, and Fire. The song is September. And Mark, is it possible to sit still to a song like that? That song moves in more ways than any song I've ever heard before.
I tell you, I was moving around while it was on. Yeah. I mean, euphemistically in the industry, that song is known as the song that never ends because you literally could sort of run a loop on that thing for about 2 hours. And I'm sure somebody on YouTube has done this. And I don't think you'd ever, it would never bother you. You'd never be irritated by the fact that it was going on and on.
This was a song that wound up being added to their greatest hits album, right?
Yeah, like Donna Summer's On the Radio, which was added to her greatest hits album. Earth, Wind, and Fire planned on two albums in 1978, a greatest hits album and a new one called I Am. And what they did to juice sales of the greatest hits album is instead of just releasing a greatest hits album, they added a hit, or they added something they thought would be a hit. And that would sort of, people would say, oh, you know, I got all these other things, but I really want that song, so they spring for it. And that's what they did. September was created to juice the greatest hits album.
And this was a song that when Earth, Wind, and Fire played it in an arena, got everybody going nuts, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this one went to number 8 on the Billboard pop chart. And I think it's illegal in some states for this song not to be played at a wedding.
You call this band the Count Basie of disco. Why?
Because it's so orchestrated. I mean, it's orchestral. There's horns, but the horns are talking to each other like the Basie band. It's not the same. It's not swing, and it's not, you know, sections, you know, doing call and response. But the different sections, they're all talking to each other. The words are just overlaid on top. But if you just heard the instrumental of this, you'd be fine with that. You could hear the instruments singing the song, really.
You talk about a woman named Allie Willis who put the finishing touches on this song. Tell us about her and what her contribution was to September.
Yeah, she's the co-writer of this song with Maurice White and Earth, Wind, and Fire guitarist Al McKay. Allie Willis was a character. She passed away shortly after I interviewed her. And it was what she would do is she also co-wrote Boogie Wonderland. She did a lot of work with a lot of bands. She's just one of these co-writers you bring in if you want a hit. She just knew how to do it. But she teamed with Maurice White. And when she met Maurice, after being recommended, he handed her a sheet of sort of basic lines that he had. They were sort of rough, skeletal. And they start to work on it. And she hated Badia.
That's the phrase that refrains throughout the entire song.
Badia. Yeah. It's just, you know, it just goes on. And she thought it was a placeholder. She thought that it was a phonetic placeholder that Maurice had stuck in there. And Maurice is, you know, while she's saying this, Maurice is just giving her this cold look in the office. And he says, that phrase is staying. I like that. I really like that. And she goes, my God, I hate it. But fine. You want to keep it? You want to keep it. But this is what she did. I mean, she takes these skeletal words and she writes couplet lines. This is one of her lines. Our hearts were ringing in the key that our souls were singing.
Wow. That's a line.
That's Allie's specialty, coming in and turning lyrics into poetry. when they were about to record it, Ali said she dropped to her knees. She grabbed him around his thighs and knees. And she said to him, "I'm begging you to get rid of Bobby Yah. I'm begging you."
She
and
wound Marie up said, learning an important lesson as a result of
did.
That, right?
She
Which
did.
Was what, Mark?
Yes. That sometimes stuff that seems weird and doesn't make sense is the moneymaker. Is sometimes that's what, you know, you don't have to flush out all the weird stuff. Sometimes that weird stuff is actually what the human ear likes to hear.
And that's something. Well, and people today, they still think that it's not Body Yah. They think the singers are singing Party On, right?
Yeah, everybody hears it differently. It's very funny. It's kind of like the song Groovin' by mm-hmm. the Young Rascals. I as a kid, I always thought he was singing You and Me and Leslie. You know, obviously wasn't You and Me and Leslie, because it doesn't make sense. And here, Body Yah, you know, Party On. People will sing what they hear. Mm-hmm. And even when they know the lyrics aren't that, they'll sing what they hear anyway.
It's interesting. Another little nugget you have about Ali Willis is that she used to hang out at a house, I think, where Motown songs were being put together, because she was so intoxicated with the sound and the music and all of it, right?
Yeah, she grew up in Detroit, and you can't, people think people can write lyrics and they can just sort of, you know, the lyricists just write lyrics and, you know, that's their thing. You have to be, for the listener, if you think you're into music, the people that write songs are, as kids, were neurotics.
Wow.
I mean, Ali used to have her parents drop her off and she'd sit on the lawn in front of Motown so she could just hear the beat.
Wow.
And whatever she could hear coming out of that Motown house against her back.
Well, that's Mark Myers of the Wall Street Journal. His column is Anatomy of a Song. Again, his blog is jazzwax.com. I can't recommend it highly enough. Mark, you're a treasure. Always appreciate you taking the time with us. Thanks so much.
A joy, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Well, it takes a lot of work behind the scenes to bring you up to date each weekday. You can show your appreciation with a pledge of support. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.